Sharon.
Okay, I had a question. In one section you talk about, you said, I would like to build a village of tiny cottages this year at the same community center.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what kind of feedback you've gotten from people about that idea, and if people are interested in that, or if there's any organizations that are working towards the same goal.
Good question. You know, right now this whole small house movement is still kind of small, even though, you know, it's been in the New York Times, Oprah Winfrey Show, that type of thing. It's still kind of just the groundswell getting started. So, you know, we need like this critical mass to get the momentum going. But there are some small communities that have been around. I guess traditionally these are centered around sometimes religious communities. I've had nuns contact me wanting, you know, tiny homes for their nun villages and stuff. In fact, up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, there is a small community up there, and they have two tiny houses that they call hermitages on that property, and they're solar powered. Has anyone heard of this? Yeah. It's actually in kind of north of Cedar Rapids as you're going into Robbins, Iowa, but before you get to Robbins. So, and then there are these cottage communities. So I guess, yeah, let's think about where these would arise naturally. Religious retreats, Buddhist retreats, teaching retreats, vacation retreats, camping, so it's that type of thing. And some people full-time, you know, living this way. But those are the examples that have already been in place. So that would be the, you know, we'd have to learn from how that's worked and then apply it to longer term or different settings. On the resourcesforlife.com website, you know, if you go to Small House Society or smallhousesociety.org, under the link for resources, you'll see a link for communities. And I'm adding to that as I hear about more of these examples. So,
Greg, one of the things that I thought about in that particular subject area was a trade-off between units that are together,
mm-hmm.
you know, blocks of apartments,
yeah.
That could be very small and saving a lot of space,
mm-hmm.
and have a very small footprint,
yeah.
not much privacy. And there's a trade-off there, although you could insulate them, I suppose. But that would still, there's an issue there. That's one extreme. And another extreme of having these a little more dispersed, with little gardens around them,
uh-huh.
with a totally different kind of impact on density, totally different density, and opposite arrangements in terms of land and the dwelling unit.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you've given much thought, and maybe the students have, to what the gains and losses would be of those two different alternative approaches to having
mm-hmm.
small dwellings in an area together, so that you could have a community of small dwellings, apartments on the one hand with small footprint, then collective land around, or dispersed small houses, each with its own little piece of land.
Yeah. I think, if I could just respond and then we can get some feedback from other people as well, but I spent some time over at the Lodge here in Iowa City, which is probably as close as we come locally to some sort of ideal small, simple living, sharing resources. They have shared basketball courts, shared fitness center, tanning for people that want that. I mean, places to have events. So the apartments, therefore, can be a little bit smaller than they normally would be because they don't have to have the exercise equipment in each apartment. It's shared, you know. And certainly from a density standpoint, it seemed like, you know, it was much more efficient than having... there was a New York Times article about one of the small house people who was on 160 acres and then had this, you know, tiny house on 160 acres. So, you know, that doesn't sound very efficient. So as far as efficiency and dealing with, you know, housing issues and overpopulation and that type of thing, I guess, you know, going vertical seems to be the way to do it, and then just trying to integrate more shared services. If you think of, let's say, Seville Apartments or some of these just sort of generic boxy apartments, they don't really have a community center, they don't have shared facilities, so what happens in those situations is you're, you know, living with these people right next to you, but you're not really getting to interact with anybody. You're not having that personal interaction. There's some cooperative houses here in Iowa City, but that maybe ends up being a little bit too interactive, you know, for what some people would want to just go home and have some quiet time. Well, you go home and then there's these 12 other people like living in the house with you that you sort of know. And so there are those gradations of, you know, apartments, you don't know anybody, a place like the lodge where you're kind of interacting, a cooperative house where everybody's constantly interacting. And then what I really think is, at least from the human experience standpoint, the ideal are just these little houses, you know, little houses, little cottages, and sharing, having a lot of green space, open space, so you really have a sense of community, but then there's also some solitude there. And surprisingly, the topic that comes up quite a bit on the Small House Society discussion list is zero population growth or negative population growth. You know, they're saying, why are we trying to solve, you know, a population problem with like housing? You know, let's start dealing with the real issue, because just the population issue alone impacts all these other things. You know, the pollution and the industrialization and all of that. So if we really just separate ourselves from the population issue and say, what do people really enjoy? I think most people would enjoy living in a little cabin instead of living in some sort of drywall thrown together kind of apartment building, even if you are like sharing some resources with people. But any other thoughts?
I can't remember if you mentioned it in the book, but like obviously like you know, these units are only for like 200 people possibly, so when you have a larger family, do you have any other thing in mind? Like, will they have a little bit of a bigger space, or does that just not work for a family?
Well, that's what I tell people. You know, part of the magic trick of me living in a 10x7 house is that, you know, I'm just one person. So as soon as you multiply that by 4 or 5, you know, you get a larger house. And certainly, you know, if you're talking about, let's say, two parents, a couple of kids. Kids have a little more energy level. They need some space to play. So you would want more space. One of the aspects of living small and living simple that I mentioned in the book is how you really kind of have to find some contentment inside, because you're not going to have all the material things on the outside if that was an issue for you. You know, like if you really wanted to have lots of stuff around to feel happy. But once you're okay with not having a lot of stuff around, which is why I think it appeals to like these Buddhists and nuns and people, writers or whoever, that are just off going on a retreat or wanting solitude. If you're content with that, and then you raise your kids to be content with that, where they don't need to have a lot of stuff, you know, then it becomes more feasible. And if, kind of like, well, with the situation with the lodge, anyone can live there. Their families living there, their people, construction workers, whoever, people can live there, but it's targeted towards students. So the theme is sort of student living, and that's what the events kind of are about. Oh, and they have a bus, which I just saw coming over here, the lodge bus, the shuttle and all. But if it was, you know, families, you could have it kind of focused on what are the needs and interests of young families, you know. And then that community would serve those needs. And maybe something that you wouldn't have over at the lodge, but you might have in this alternative village, is, you know, have a daycare right there, have a playground, have maybe even a small school or something. You know, you could really have an intentional community for small families. So there again, the resources that would be shared, it wouldn't necessarily be like the basketball court or the tanning. You know, it would be something that young families would want. So they'd say, oh, well, what we'd want to do is have, you know, a playroom where the kids can play. We just, like, share toys. You don't have to have, like, toys duplicated across 10 homes, you know, and share the resources that are needed for raising kids, you know. What do you think, Seth?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that's feasible to a certain extent. I mean, it just makes you wonder about, like, if the community gets too densely populated, if you're sharing these things, like, as you see problems arising, like, you know, if you're sharing bathrooms and you're sharing all these facilities, if there's too many people, or, you know, if there's always someone on your, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and just to finish that up, and I saw another hand go up here, but when I was living on Dodge Street for a couple of years, I was running a 10x12 room, and there was a nice closet space, so it was comfortable. Bed, desk, little refrigerator, microwave. But I was sharing the bathroom upstairs with the other residents there. So there were three of us sharing the upstairs with one bathroom. And even that kind of became a hassle because, the bathroom's available 24 hours a day and there are only three of us, except like we all kind of wanted to leave at the same time in the morning. So, you know, I'd never know. I'd wake up in the morning, is somebody going to be in the shower? So I got into this routine right away because I sort of like dependability. I thought, okay, I'm just going to wake up and go to the gym and then work out and shower at the gym and then start my day. I'm not even going to bother even trying to go to the bathroom or use the shower or whatever in the morning. I'm just going to get up and get out of the house. So, I can see this being a problem. You know, that was just three people. You know, you get like 5-10 people trying to share just a small bathroom, and that could be an issue. Yeah?
Well, kind of what I was thinking as I was reading is, like, it's probably unrealistic that most people are going to live, like, in that small of a house.
Yeah.
You know, people like their own space and everything. Like, mm-hmm. me, like, I'd like to have guests over and socialize, and I'd love to cook. I could never do it without a kitchen, you know?
Uh-huh.
But then I was thinking maybe, like, something like a neighborhood area where there's houses. And, like, I'm also living simply, but, like, still need some space or
right.
something, you know, and maybe some different rooms. But but just like maybe sharing like things. Like, you know, not every house needs a lawnmower or not every house needs a ladder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like having maybe a collection of something like that. And maybe like when you said like the daycare, like that would sound like something like in the center.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you don't need like all the toys and everything, but maybe still like so that people can still have their own space and their own house and have their own yard to do what they want with and everything.
Even something like one of those really nice juicers, it's $300. I mean, who wants to spend $300 on a juicer? You're just going to use it like once a week or something. But, just little things like that. There could be like a nicer kitchen and then the smaller kitchen.
Yeah.
With my house, it's so extreme. I guess that's part of the discovery of it is by going, you know, pushing the envelope, I'm going to discover some challenges that I might not have discovered if it was like 1,000 square feet. But that's what I hear most often from people is I want, you know, more space for guests, an actual full-size kitchen with a refrigerator, et cetera, shower, bathroom, that type of thing. You know, it definitely works well as like a retreat. And for me, I've made it work, you know, on the day-to-day. But I'm engaged now, and so people are asking me, like, so what are you going to do? Are you both going to live in that little house? And, you know, our plan right now is just to get an apartment close to downtown, avoid having to use a car all the time for shopping and work and stuff, but then start saving up to buy land and build a house. So, you know, if we were able to do that right away, great, that would be our ideal. And what I'd like to do is build, like, something then the next step up from what I have where people, instead of seeing it and saying, oh, that's interesting, I could never do that, you know, to build and live in and really make it work, you know, have a house that people would look at and say, wow, yeah, I could do that. That's, you know, 700 square feet, something like that, 500, where people would really say, yeah, that's totally doable. Have a full kitchen in there, but really make efficient use of the space, you know, so that even though it's small, there'd be the functionality of a larger home. So,
like, that sounds good, just since, like, if you build it, then, you know, it would kind of be, like, easily functioning to everything that you need and, like, your lifestyle. Because usually, like, if you buy a house, it's set up already,
mm-hmm.
maybe not as efficient as your life would need.
Right.
I have a question about the responsibility that is involved with sharing facilities, say, like you said, a bathroom and things like that. Obviously, people have different preferences on how clean things are kept and things like that. I know that from living with people.
Mm-hmm.
It's obvious. Anyway, I guess what I'm saying is, if you get a bunch of people together, who's in charge of keeping things clean or restocking things? And is there, say, for example, a daycare is an example of everyone sharing those resources, but obviously the daycare is in charge of keeping everything in order and clean and all that kind of stuff. So I was just wondering what would be the regulation on that kind of stuff, because obviously if no one's responsible, then no one takes care of it.
Yeah, I think what often happens in, you know, larger group dynamics or even in just relationships to spouses, you know, it's like the person who is the most nitpicky ends up having to do everything, you know? Because if your, you know, level of acceptance of clutter is like, you know, not quite there with your partner who you're with, you know, it's like you're going to be doing the dishes all the time, where they're like, oh, let them sit for a few days, you know, let's just wait till the mold starts growing, you know? But yeah, you know, I think what happens a lot of times is you have actually somebody who'll print up a piece of paper and it'll be like, okay, you know, everybody on a certain day has to do their share of cleaning the bathroom or doing the dishes or whatever. Another example that comes to mind here in Iowa City, college town, we have these fraternities and sororities, and that's kind of like cooperative housing, intentional community. It's around the Greek culture thing, but, you know, yeah, I guess in any situation there needs to be some guidelines. And there's some people that are okay with sloppy, you know? So that would almost be a defining factor, like, to that intentional community. Are you one of these, like, really neat and tidy people, or are you a sloppy person? And you'd almost have to set up the community based on that, you know? And some people stress out if everything has to be all tidy. They're like, I don't even want to deal with that, you know? So if that's a stressor, yeah, it would need to be kind of determined ahead of time. But yeah, you definitely don't want like messy kitchens and bathrooms. Right. Yeah.
I was just, when I was reading this, I was wondering about the level of continuity between people in the small house movement or in people who were building small houses. Are the house layouts similar? Like, does everyone have, like, not have a bathroom? And is there any, like, crossover with, because I know also, like, alternative construction, like super adobe huts and geodesic domes, is there any, like, or sort of connection to that at all?
Maybe it's just me, but what I've been noticing is that a lot of these small house people are really independent. You know, not like they don't want to work together, it's just like their nature, you know. So people often ask me, oh, so who are the other like 10 small house people around Iowa? And I'm like, I don't know, I'm just kind of, I do my own thing, you know. We don't really like have regular small house meetings and such. There's a lot of discussion.
It's your room?
Yeah, there's no room. Yeah.
So very small.
Yeah. So, but yeah, and then there are like, you know, people that are really into adobe or straw bale, you know, different kinds of materials. There are people into just sort of the not so big house phenomenon, which is like, you know, 1,500 square feet instead of 1,600 square feet. I'm being silly. So, but you know, there, yeah, different people often different avenues of this. There are people that consider themselves as part of the movement who are living in RVs, you know, people that go to campgrounds and spend half the year, maybe all year.
Yeah.
And RVs are kind of, you know, efficient. And if you're in a warmer climate, you don't have to worry about, you know, heating and insulation and stuff. But yeah, you know, there do seem to be some similarities in design, I think, just because of necessity. You have to have it be efficient. Most of the homes are going to have, like you're talking about, the amenities of the kitchen and the bathroom and all of that. I think it's unusual to find ones that are without those facilities. But Dee Williams, who's been on Good Morning America and has had some major news coverage, she's in, I think it's Olympia, Washington, and similar situation as mine. She has her house in somebody's backyard, and she doesn't have a shower or a bathroom in there. She has a nice little kitchen.
She lives in Washington. It rains all the time. Well, she has to step outside.
Yeah, there you go. There's your shower. So, but and then the people she knows, they're like, they say, yeah, whatever. You can come in, use the bathroom, use the shower. So she has full access to the house, and it's, I think, about 30 or 40 feet away. And she has her little garden out there. So, yeah, but I think most people don't want to, if it's raining or cold, they don't want to get up and have to walk to go take a shower or use the bathroom. But I, for me, I sort of like the adventure of it, you know.
Well, one of the things you point out is that some of these things can work at different times in one's life cycle,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we do have different arrangements that we'll be able to make. Philip?
I had a question. I think a few of us were wondering if you own the land that your house is on, or if you, like, if it was public land maybe or something like that.
Oh. Where my house is at here in town is on some property that's been in our family for a couple of generations. So that just worked out fine. And when Jay was here, because we were really talking about like trying to start this movement, and I said, why don't we try to like get some land and have these houses on the land? He already had his house that he purchased on Dewey Street, and then his home was in the backyard. Did I mention this?
Mm-mm.
Oh, this is really interesting. Yeah, here in town. So his idea was, he basically wanted a place to live for free, and he wanted his personal equity and net worth to be growing every month by like $1,000 a month. So who wouldn't want that? So what he did was, he bought this house, then he rented the house. He rented the house for more than what the mortgage payments were. So now he had like income coming in for doing nothing really. Then he set up his tiny house in the backyard and didn't charge himself rent because it's his backyard. So then he got a place to live for free, and then he ended up selling the house. And of course, the way it worked out for him, it was great because he bought the house for nothing and he sold it for a whole bunch. So, you know, that's one option. And I was thinking about going over there, but the landscape was really tricky. It's like this little valley in the backyard. And I mean, I don't know if you had to get like a Caterpillar tractor or something to get his house out of there, but it, like, it's just grass and mud and stuff, so I didn't even want to go try it. And then I asked my dad and stepmom about using their yard, which is just ideal because it's close to town, easy to access. There aren't any, like, not too many low-hanging tree branches or wires or anything. And my house is 13 and a half feet high, so there are a lot of considerations. I didn't really want it in any place that would get too muddy or be difficult to access. So this is, you know, it's flat, right on the street. It's perfect. But if I didn't have that option, I probably, like D. Williams, I would just be asking around and seeing, is there somebody I could pay, you know, $50, $100 a month, depending on how much of their amenities I was taking advantage of, you know.
Sure.
Thanks. I lived in the communal situation two times in my life.
Yeah.
Hated it both times. Once when I came here as a freshman in the fraternity, and once when I was a member of the United States government in the Army.
Yeah.
And everything was resume. Everything.
Yeah.
My food, my sleep, my shower, we changed it. And it's not the American way of living at all.
Yeah.
No, he didn't want, he was saying he doesn't want the regimentation either.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway. Secondly, from a financial standpoint, you're not going to get a bank to even touch you.
As far as the loan, yeah, they don't know how to put
a loan. I went through this thing in Fairfield. You spoke of Fairfield.
Yeah.
I was a banker there for 31 years, and I know the nut people down there.
Are there?
The things that are started fall flat on their face within 36 months.
Well, let me bring up something that comes into that, because I think it's important to be able to see. And I want to hold on the idea here that there's a whole lot that's in this, not all of which would somebody have to adopt. You can adopt parts of this without adopting, you know, everything. There are a couple of models that I know that have some aspects of what you're talking about. And there are two very different cultures. They're across the English Channel from each other. But one would be Le Courvoisier, or however it's pronounced. So those of you who speak French can do it better than I can. But this is a guy who designed apartment buildings that were to be self-contained. They would have the shopping. They would have everything that a person would need, and the idea, a lot of the employment even. Some people would have to then take public transportation to get to someplace else. But it would be an integrated apartment complex. And I've got photographs of a couple of his buildings, some in Marseille, some in Paris. This was all done back in the 50s and 60s, after World War II, really moving things along, trying to develop a sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
And so families of different ages would live in this. You know, that's so one kind of a model. Second kind of a model was the British New Towns. Even before World War II, actually, between the wars, there was a plan to build a series of new towns as places to grow instead of having the big metropolitan areas grow. Now, many of them were connected by high-speed public transportation in the suburbs within commuting distance of major cities, but the theory was these were to be self-contained communities that would have everything you needed, including jobs. Right? So the people that worked in the shops, the people that worked in the small factories, the little plants that they would have, would live there. That's the theory. Now, part of what broke down
in both of these cases was a fundamental change in terms of work arrangements in French and British culture that we've experienced in this culture. Two-job households. It was fine if only one person had to get to work. But once you've got two people, he may have a job one place, she may have a job another place. And if they want any kind of long-term relationship, right, if one of them's going to move jobs, the other one has to move job too. And I assure you, that's a real burden. As those of you who are making your relationships and on, this can be a real problem. And in fact, yesterday, my wife and I drove up to an event at Wartburg, and we were driving past Cedar Rapids at 5:30, and looking at all the traffic. The traffic of all the Iowa City people who work in Cedar Rapids, and all the Cedar Rapids people who work in Iowa City. And a lot of that is because one person works in each place. Now, that's terrific in terms of these people both being able both to have jobs. And relative to a big city, it's not so far. And it's nothing like commuting in L.A. or New York or Chicago. And still. But that runs counter to the Le Corbusier model and counter to the British New Town. Now, British New Towns are regarded as a success or a failure depending on which element of them you look at. They're wonderful places to live, but people who live in them don't work in them. So in terms of the sense that everybody would do everything in the new town and not commute, they're a failure. In the sense of having nice places to live, they're a success. Okay. Now, one of the issues I wanted to get at, make sure we got at before we leave off here, is how regulations affect the ability to live small, because it is contrary, okay? And customs, I would put back in terms of banking. Could we change the way we finance things to make it possible for these things to be successful, and what kind of connections would there be? That's the one side. The other side is when environmental problems get to be serious enough, we do something about it. And an example we have this last year is the extent to which people stopped driving. When the gas was up to $3 a gallon, people drove less. A lot more people took public transportation. Okay. Some of them are still taking public transportation even though the price of gasoline has gone down. Okay?
Today?
Yep, it's made a difference. Okay, now, so should we respond before the problems get to be too high by coming up with some kind of public encouragement, some kind of public policies that are going to encourage people to put their lives on a diet before simply a collapse of the economy or a collapse of the environmental system makes us put our lives on a diet, that we don't have any choice. Right? And these two things are related. The regulations in terms of being able to build them, and then regulations in terms of encouraging people to behave in ways that are less consumptive instead of the ways that we're encouraged now. To give you an example, there are public policies that encourage consumption by giving people discounts if they consume a lot of something. And it's not just that you go buy at Sam's Club and buy in bulk, but even governments giving people discounts if you're going to use more than so much water, you pay less instead of paying more. You use more than so much electricity, you pay less rather than more. Because they know they would have a customer. That may be in the short-term interest of the government or the utility. It's not in the long-term interest of the society. Okay. So, guess what I would... The point here is, how do we alter regulations and customs in order to encourage people to be more efficient in terms of what they do rather than to encourage people to be less efficient? Yeah. Brittany's going to answer that. Everybody write this down.
You just got me thinking about, it seems hard to regulate, how people buy things, like how much things they buy. Like if you want them to like be consuming less, it seems kind of hard to regulate that. And maybe it's just more education, like trying to like just get the word out and educate people, like of how to maybe like consume things, like pick some products over some others, and just I think it's definitely more education because you can't tell people like you can't purchase like two TVs, you can only have one or something, you know, like.
But you could tax differently.
Yeah.
So if you have a car registered to you, and you buy another car, and you keep the first one registered to you, that your cost of registering the second car would be substantially higher. No registration, but that's easy enough to check because the cops could be checking on that. There are ways for some things.
I think, Greg, you had some good ideas on a smaller scale that we're all guilty of, by letting faucets run, by standing in the shower too long, by turning the lights off. Remember when was it Kennedy or somebody like that set a precedent in Washington, D.C. about turning the lights off? But there were a lot of it. I was doing some cleaning at my house yesterday, and I was back in the bedroom, and I could feel cold air. And I hadn't paid any attention to it, because I was asleep back there anyway. And all of a sudden, the window, the top part of it, had slid down to the bottom, and there was a crack up there. Mm-hmm. And I was heating the outside. Mm-hmm. And all I had to do was push it up and put the lock on. I lived in my house for probably 4 years, and there's a vent in the top, because I got hot water, baseboard hot water heat. I never knew I was supposed to close it there and thing in the wintertime. I somebody said, well, that's one of the reasons why your heat bills are so high, because it's going out the ceiling. But there's just little things like that that I think from an environmental standpoint we could focus on. Well, I'm not on you on the other side, but I'm going to compliment you on this side.
Well, to follow up on what you mentioned earlier, I mean, people are concerned about the viability of this. And it's true. You know, I mean, the banker, it's not that they're just not interested in small houses. It has to be proven to be a viable investment of money, and these people aren't going to move away in 3 years.
You can't plot up a little tiny sample of land that you can get an abstract to that in between your house and my house, for example.
And then, you know, realtors, if they can sell a big house over here and make a big commission, why would they want to sell a small house? So it kind of has some things going against it in terms of...
Well, consider, for example, the incentives that we have within our economy right now to buy as much house as you possibly can. Because, it's 15, 20 years now. The only kind of interest that you could deduct on your income tax was your mortgage. So that encourages people to have all their debt on their house. But it also encourages people, especially if you think over the long term the value of houses is going to go up, it encourages people in this country to buy as much house as possible financially. There is an encouragement by the way the tax system works. Right? And I've contrasted this geographical literature that looks at the difference between Canada and the U.S. And if you take the pair of cities that are similar, so Vancouver and Seattle, Winnipeg and Minneapolis, similar pair, there is more multiple family housing in the Canadian cities. There is more single family housing in the American cities. But as well, the average house size is bigger relative to the income. Because they don't have the kind of tax subsidy of big houses that we have. I mean, we really do have it, and it's a tax break that only goes to people who have enough money to be able to buy a house. If you don't have enough money to buy a house, you can't get that tax break.
Well, a lot of people, refinanced their houses when the interest rates got a little lower, and they bought a new car, and they couldn't deduct the interest on the car, but they could put incorporate the whole thing.
Oh, I did that.
Okay.
Absolutely. I keep as much of my debt as possible on my house.
And just recently, this year, I mean, I have tons of equity in my house. How am I going to get it out? Die? My kids are going to get it. So I just mortgage it.
Yeah.
Heck of it. I could get a low interest rate.
Sure.
I can deduct the mortgage. I'm only paying 1%, theoretically. from the bank, put the money in the bank for CDs.
Right.
I didn't spend money.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Well, we refinanced a couple times when the interest rates went down. We're paying less than 5%, you know, on our mortgage.
And I think I paid 5.5%.
But you know, there's a little bit of cost to do it. But you know, that's.
Sure.
But the point I'm making here, going back to part of what you've said, is that you can use fiscal incentives. And one of the backward ones that we don't use enough is that we either use what's called postage stamp pricing, or we give people benefits for buying more. Postage stamp pricing means you pay the same no matter how far the letter goes. If you mail, if I mail something to the person across the street from me, let's say for example I got a check that I've got to give to a neighbor for our road fund to do the plowing for the road this winter. If I mail it to her, it costs me the same as if I mail something to Alaska. 42 cents is what it costs. Well, obviously it costs less to get it to her across the street than it does to cost to get it to Alaska. But worse than that is that we charge people less if they buy a lot of something, when we ought to be charging them less if they buy a little of something. And if we had a graduated cost, and the example of the car was a good one, Brittany. If you have more than one car and you know registered to you, that you should pay more for the registration to discourage people from having a whole bunch of cars. And the people that are wealthy enough to have multiple cars, and we saw this with a neighbor, Bob Norton, who used to coach basketball at Regina and later taught global studies at Northwest Junior High, is my next door neighbor, and one of his sons was flooded out. And while they're getting their house fixed down by City Park, he's been living with his parents next door. Well, you know, he's a typical, you know, middle class, you know, 30-something American. He's got three cars. You know, what does he have? He has a little sedan, he has an SUV, and he has a pickup. Now, he's got to have all three cars, right? Well, no. No. So if he were paying, the whatever the flat rate would be for the first car, and then paying, you know, $300 for the second car, and $1,000 for the third car, he might give that a second thought. And if he still does it, then at least that's that money that goes in that maybe could be used for public transportation. Yeah. That would be what I would be arguing, is that we can use economic incentives to get people to behave more responsibly. And we tend not to do that. And I think there are good series of things in here that we could be learning from in terms of doing it. Your water consumption. We could say the first, X cubic feet of water you use would cost a little bit, and everybody gets to have that. But anything that you're going to use above that, you pay through the nose for. So if you're going to take a long hot shower, you pay for it. The person that's going to be frugal and doesn't take that doesn't pay for it.
That's really fascinating, because that's consistent with what we see in other areas of marketplace economics, and that is that a person can almost live for free, right? Maybe I'm overstating it, but I mean, you can right now walk over to the library, watch DVDs. You don't have to pay to rent DVDs from a movie rental store anymore. So you get that at the library, and then you need to use the equivalent of Lexus or Westlaw, which used to be $200 an hour, but now it's for free on Google. So, you know, and then you maybe walk by the co-op and they have a lot of samples of food, so you get some food. And no, there is a free lunch. Well, let me get to what I'm saying. So, you know, there are a lot of companies out there then that offer something for free. And ABG Antivirus is a free antivirus program. Now, they have a commercial version, and you can pay for that. Let's see, there are other places that offer a certain amount of hosting, for example, with advertising. And there are lots of examples of where you can get a little of something for free. Certainly with public education, you get a lot of something for free. I mean, it's not totally free. Somebody's paying for it. But there's public education, there are roads, there are libraries, there are a lot of services. Some people now are talking about health care, at least a basic level of health care for free. So there could be even water and electricity and internet service. I mean, you could have a basic level of services that would be inexpensive or free,
And in order to make sure nobody just, you don't have thousands of people just sitting around home watching TV and waiting for somebody to deliver their free food, you'd have to have a certain motivating factor out there. But I think a lot of people are motivated just because they're motivated anyway. You don't have to say, if you don't work, you're not going to eat. I mean, most people want to do something anyway.
Okay. I have to go participate in a panel discussion over in international programs. Dan, Brittany, Tyler, Kevin, Philip can all leave, and Sarah, the rest of you have to stay until you've asked him a question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, everybody.
That's my question. You've asked me this.
You can't.